Hey, listeners, we wanted to give you a preview of our new podcast, Making the Call. The first season explores the true stories and ethical dilemmas of COVID-19. Listen as we talk to healthcare workers and other people on the front lines of the pandemic. Want to hear more? Up next is a preview of Making the Call. Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts for the full story.
And I had this sudden feeling that I was being asked to like sell my dad's life, you know, to like make his life seem worth it to keep him on the ventilator. I wanted this doctor to think that my dad is worth it.
COVID-19 is overwhelming our healthcare system. As cases increase exponentially across the United States, it's clear we just don't have enough resources to go around.
For weeks, we haven't even had a reliable estimate of how many people actually have the disease, because we don't have enough tests. And many hospitals are now facing shortages of masks, beds, and life-saving ventilators.
Americans have watched with horror the stories from Italy and now Spain of rationing supplies and care. But rationing is already here. This is Making the Call, a podcast about how we make impossible choices. I'm Zeke Emanuel. I'm an oncologist and health policy expert.
I'm Jonathan Moreno. I'm a philosopher and historian.
We've both devoted our lives to the study of bioethics, to understanding what's right, what's wrong, and what it means to make decisions about another person's health.
On this show, we're talking to the experts and leaders who are charged with setting ethical guidelines during this unprecedented global pandemic, and the frontline first responders who carry the weight of these decisions every day. In this episode, doctors in the United States aren't used to dealing with scarcity. Now, they're being forced to make tough decisions about rationing care. Decisions like, how do you decide who gets the ventilator when there aren't enough for every patient who needs one?
Jonathan, we're going to be talking about bioethics a lot in this podcast. You were one of the founders of the field. What do you think bioethics is? How do you describe it when you'd have someone who doesn't really understand it?
I describe bioethics as the study of human values in medicine and the life sciences. That's pretty formal. But to me, the key to understanding bioethics is how we now expect doctors to tell us the truth. And that sounds pretty basic, but in fact, that historically has not been the expectation of doctors. The expectation was they would assess us, they'd tell us how they were going to fix us or they weren't going to fix us, but they wouldn't necessarily tell us exactly what they thought was wrong if we couldn't handle it. And I think that doctor-patient relationship, that change of our expectations, that's really how I define bioethics.
I think your point at the top is right. It's about how values intermix with medical care as well as the life sciences and all of the issues that people identify, end-of-life care, euthanasia, issues related to creating new organisms. That's all of bioethics. And one of the things that has always intrigued me as a bioethicist is the fact that this is really ancient. I like to say that ever since the start of medicine, someone caring for a sick person, you've had to have bioethical codes. Hippocrates is 400 BC, and there's a reason it goes that far back, because the moment someone's caring for someone with a naked body that's sick, that's in distress, that needs help, it raises all sorts of ethical issues. And you need ethical guidance. What's the right thing to do in this circumstance? And that's really what bioethics is about.
So you would think, Zeke, that we have been well prepared for this by our work in bioethics over the decades, but it feels like to some extent we've been very involved in sort of sexy high-tech issues like gene editing and brain science, the kind of stuff that interests me at least, and not as much with the way that we are tied to the biology of the planet. And this whole coronavirus crisis is kind of forcing us back to think about ourselves as kind of organically related to this setting in which we have evolved and which we affect and which is talking back to us. It always does. but it's roaring back at us now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, it's often said that all the bioethics dilemmas are a result of new technologies, but this isn't about new technology. This is about ancient organisms, viruses. So it is a very, very challenging moment, I think, for the whole world and for bioethicists to give advice to policymakers, hospitals, individual clinicians. It just seems a little overwhelming that things we've dealt with in theory and in papers are now real life with real implications for other people's lives.
Zeke, I think a lot of people think of ethics as an academic field that is kind of in the ivory tower. But as we're learning now, especially, these issues are not just academic. They're real. They involve real people, real problems, real decisions with real consequences. So in every episode of this show, we're going to start with a personal story from the front lines of the fight against the coronavirus.
Yeah, today I think we're going to hear from a daughter of a COVID-19 patient in New Jersey. For a lot of reasons, she just didn't want us to use her real name, so we'll be calling her Susan. But like so many patients and family members and healthcare workers, she's worried about what will happen if care needs to be rationed, how her father is going to get the right care, and whether he can actually get the care he needs.
Susan's father is in his 80s. He's divorced, he lives alone, and he's pretty adamant about his independence. Susan lives in California, and he lives in New Jersey, but they talk all the time.
Wednesday, March 18th, my dad said he was feeling very poorly and that he had even been thinking of calling 911. So Friday the 20th, he went to the hospital. I spoke to him like an hour and a half later. He was in the emergency room. Naturally, he like forgot to turn his cell phone on, even though he had it with him. You know, so they had to track him down. He was sitting in the emergency room and they said he was having, I think they told me initially that he was having very bad asthma. No one mentioned a fever to me. And since my dad has asthma, I was like, man, this is a shitty time to have a bad asthma attack. You know, that's all I was thinking. And then Tuesday, he suddenly got worse and they had to intubate him, which is put him on a ventilator.
After he was intubated, they moved Susan's father to the ICU. He'd been tested for COVID-19, but it still took several days to get the results. He was positive for the disease.
Within a few days, basically the ICU was so overwhelmed that they couldn't do the family calls anymore. So somewhere a few days ago, it started that they have farmed out the calling to a guy who's a hematological oncologist who is not seeing my dad and is not in the hospital. And he's literally just like reading the computer for the latest reports and he tells it to me. The ICU is so overwhelmed that they can't talk to me and I don't call them. I think there was one night a few days ago where I called like at night before I went to sleep just to ask if my dad was still alive. And she said, let me transfer you. And then she just transferred me to a ringing line that never answered. Like that's a real thing that happened.
Susan's father lives in New Jersey now, but he's a native New Yorker.
My dad was born in 1936 in Brooklyn. He was an electrical engineer. He was an early computer programmer. Like he was doing computer stuff when computers were not called computers yet. At the same time, he's also a passionate amateur dancer. Actually, when I was younger, at a certain point, my dad was going dancing every night. So there were years of my life where my dad went dancing 7 nights a week. My dad is good at every kind of dancing, all kinds of Latin dancing, all kinds of ballroom dancing, many kinds of folk dancing, country western dancing. Like there isn't like a dance that two people do together that my dad doesn't know, as well as also like circle and set and square dances and contra dances and everything. Balkan, Israeli, Greek. You know, his activities have kind of like decreased. Like as his diabetes got worse, the more insulin he was given, the more his weight ballooned and he's struggled a lot to keep his weight down. And that has impacted his health in all kinds of ways, making his asthma worse, making his sciatica worse, which sort of gives you a sense of like where he's at.
Given his age and his health problems, once her father tested positive for COVID-19, Susan knew that he was in real danger.
From almost as soon as I heard they were putting him on the ventilator, because I've been following the news from other countries, I was already concerned about, will they decide to take my dad off the ventilator and give it to someone younger who needs it? Like, you know, you see the reports out of Italy and stuff where you're talking about doctors are having to make life or death type decisions.
Her father had gone to one of the top hospitals in his part of New Jersey. but she still didn't know if they had enough ventilators. And when she asked if they had enough ventilators, the story kept changing.
When I first asked, is there any chance they would take my dad off the ventilator, I think I was first told, no, we have enough ventilators. That's not something that's happening here. And then another time I was told, they're not going to do that to someone who's in the course of treatment. That would more be a concern for new people coming in who need it. They're not going to rip someone off it who's already on it. The first time I talked to the doctor who's not actually like seeing my dad, but doing like the daily reporting for me, he said to me, tell me a little bit about your dad, about his life. And I didn't know why he was asking me that. You know, he was like, does he live alone? I said, yes. And he said, what does he do? And I explained he's retired and here's all his interests. And I had this sudden feeling that I was being asked to like sell my dad's life, you know, to like make his life seem worth it to keep him on the ventilator. Now that may not be the case. He may have been asking more for the like, what happens when he goes home kind of thing. But he asked something about like, what does my dad do? Or like something about his life. And I felt like I had to sell my dad's life. Like I was picturing, are they thinking, does this guy get the ventilator or this 35-year-old with two young kids? Like, I'll never know if that's why he asked me. I tried to be very like bright and energetic and positive in describing my dad's life. And I made my dad sound like all sort of like more involved and vigorous than he is. And I felt sort of like guilty that my dad is an 83-year-old guy who lives alone, who has health problems. Like he's the, I guess, classic COVID patient who dies. And I wanted this doctor to think that my dad is worth it to keep him on the ventilator if they get to a situation where they don't have enough ventilators. And yeah, it made me, I don't know. I mean, fortunately, a couple days later, his prognosis started to get better. And since I've heard for 2 days in a row that he's slightly better, I guess I have less fear that they'll rip him off the ventilator. But until he's actually off the ventilator, I'm afraid that they'll rip him off the ventilator, no matter what people have said to me.
Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts for the full story.